Hey, everybody. Welcome again to F This Movie, the official podcast of FThisMovie.net. Movie love for movie lovers. My name is Patrick Bromley, and I'm very excited to be talking tonight about 2009's Watchmen with the man who watches the Watchmen, Mr. Heath Holland.
Heath Holland's Journal. Recorded a podcast with Patrick Bromley tonight. This microphone stinks of cheap bourbon. The squeaking chair smells of piss and regret. Outside, the clueless masses walk by with their faces and their phones, connected to lives that aren't their own. One day, perhaps they'll look me up on Twitter or Facebook and say, "Follow me, friend me," and I will whisper, "Okay."
Two things. One, stop drinking bourbon during the podcast. Two, stop peeing on your chair, man.
Listen, if you drink the bourbon, you pee on the chair. If I stop the bourbon, then one takes care of the other. I'll work on it.
I'm not going to make any promises. No, I appreciate it. We're going to be talking about Watchmen a little bit later in the show, and probably spoiling Watchmen. So if you've never seen the film or read the comic, we will be spoiling many elements of it. So you might want to go check those out before you listen in. Because there's lots to talk about with this movie, and it seemed appropriate given the fact that the latest trailer for visionary director Zack Snyder's Batman v Superman Dawn of Justice dropped this week. And maybe after we talk about what we've seen lately, Heath, I'd love to hear your thoughts as a Batman fanatic. I would love to hear your thoughts on that trailer.
Okay.
The year is winding down. There's only a few weeks left, and we're only about, a little over a week and a half away from a new Star Wars movie. Heath, how are you holding up?
I'm okay. I'm actually getting nervous. I watched the original trilogy again this week.
One, two, and three?
That's right.
Got it.
The extended editions with the added news. No, I watched the unaltered 4, 5, and 6 because that's usually what I watch. Standard definition, but you know what? It's better than some of those changes. I am getting nervous because I don't think it's going to be a bad movie. I think it's going to be a really good movie, but it's the thing. Like right now, The Force Awakens is nothing but potential. I mean, it could be the greatest thing ever, or it could be really bad. I mean, I don't know, but people are excited about it. And I know that this excitement, it will have to go away as soon as people start to see the movie. And there will be people who don't like the movie. I mean, I could be one of them, but I doubt it. But you know what I mean? Like, this is the end. Like this, there will never, there was a headline. I don't remember who it was, or I'd give him credit for it, but there was a headline that said, you will not live to see the last Star Wars movie.
I remember seeing that somewhere.
And I think that that's true. Like now that Disney has it, it's great because they obviously know what to do with it and they know how to market it and they know what makes money and they know what people want to see. But at the same time, I don't know how I feel about that. Like they will make Star Wars movies until we are all gone and they will be making them for our children and our children's children. And right now, I'm just enjoying this last wave, but I'm also trying to distance myself and pull back just a little bit because this is it. This is the end.
Yeah, I like that idea that like right now it's nothing but potential. Just prepare yourself for the fact that there will be hyperbole on both sides. And some people will be overly enthusiastic because they just are so excited that they can't quite divorce their excitement from their reactions to the movie. Some people will legitimately love it that much. And then there will be a backlash, some from people who just feel disappointed because it didn't live up to their expectations. And then people who genuinely disliked it. Reactions will run the gamut. It's just that the internet makes that a megaphone, you know?
It does.
And everyone's going to be racing to get their opinions out fastest and loudest.
And it can't be what some people want it to be, right? Like, it can't be your childhood gift wrapped and given back to you, right? Like, there's no way.
No,
right?
No movie can, except for Turbo Kid. So do you already know when you're seeing it? Do you have your ticket and everything?
Yeah, we were one of those people that got our tickets that – it was actually the night after that football trailer, the trailer that during the football game. So, yeah, we're seeing it 8 o'clock, not in IMAX, 2D.
Yeah, because IMAX is only 3D, correct?
I think so.
Plus, this is 8 o'clock Thursday night or 8 o'clock Friday night?
Thursday.
Got it. Okay. Now, so was it the football trailer that like kind of put you over the edge? You were like, yeah, no, I guess I want to see that.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I was like, Star Wars, that's like Star Trek, but with more war. Yeah. I might have to look into this.
Yeah, yeah. I was a big fan of that Droids cartoon. Is this anything like that? So let us begin the show. So anyway, we're going to hopefully do something special for Star Wars The Force Awakens in terms of a podcast. And then after that, we'll probably start kind of our year-end series with best of lists and overrated, underrated, and all that nonsense. Still a few movies that I need to see before I'm ready to make that list. So that's kind of what's coming up. Before we talk about Watchmen, I'll ask you, Mr. Hollywood Heath Holland, have you seen anything good lately?
Yeah, I'm on like this exploitation kick. Mostly Chuck Norris.
Mostly.
But also, mostly Chuck Norris. Mostly. That's right. I'll just go through those. We can just fly through these because there's not much to say. Delta Force? Yeah, it's okay.
Did you, of course I've seen Delta Force. Did you walk around singing the theme song all day?
Mm-hmm.
You can't help it, like, because it plays all the time in that movie.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And it makes me want to go, like, vote. Vote Republican? I don't know. Like,
that movie is the goal. That was the goal of the movie.
It was so patriotic.
Robert Forster as a Middle Eastern terrorist.
Okay, I got to be honest with you. So I don't look up I don't have IMDb open when I watch movies, right? Like I like to go into movies pretty blank. And if I can avoid trailers for movies that aren't Star Wars, I'll do it. So I was watching Delta Force. I was like, this guy looks familiar. I feel like I know. Have I seen any Middle Eastern movies that he might be an actor in? And then finally, I think it was at the credits, like the end credits. I'm like, wait a minute, Max Cherry was the bad guy in this movie?
Yeah, I think that came at kind of a low point for him career-wise. Like, I don't think he was super proud of that.
But you know what? I feel like he did a really good job.
He was fine, yeah. It's just awful that they put him in
brown
face.
You mean he was fine. Yeah, no, I mean, but then again, you have to think about, like, the makers, the director of the film is an Israeli who's, I don't know. There's so much more information I want to know about the movie. Like, how did this casting process go? Was he like, well, we need an American actor who has a history with exploitation, who has a history with these kinds of movies. He wouldn't say exploitation, but like these kinds of movies. So clearly Chuck Norris and Robert Forster. I don't know. It's fascinating. I want to know more about it. Missing in Action 1, which is like way better than Missing in Action 2, but Missing in Action 2, I'll still take it. Like it's still pretty decent. I mean, at this point, there's not much that like, I'm so high on Chuck Norris right now. He could like,
this is fascinating to me because, you know, I love all these movies, but, like, I don't love Chuck Norris. Right. Was Missing in Action 2 Joseph Zito also? No, it was not. Never mind. I just looked it up. It's Lance Houle. And Missing in Action 2 is the one that's all a flashback to Vietnam, yeah?
Yeah, and in Electric Boogaloo, which you recommended on Netflix this last week, they explain that they filmed – that was going to be the first movie. They filmed back to back, and that was gonna be the first one, and then they saw the rushes or whatever and they were like, oh, this is not very good, so they made the second movie the first movie, and then the second then like whatever, they flipped them. So
right, Missing in Action 3, it was just announced, is getting a Blu-ray release from Shout Factory, and I've never seen Missing in Action 3.
No, I haven't either. And so is Invasion USA.
Yes, it is. And that I'm pretty excited about.
Yeah, you're on board for that.
Yeah.
Code of Silence, I watched, which you like.
Yes, I do. That's probably my favorite Chuck Norris movie.
Yeah, that movie is like Chicago on a plate. I mean, there's like Mike Ditka eating meat, you know. Just
robots everywhere.
Yeah, as there are in Chicago, you know. I liked it. I don't know. Some of these things is going to take a while before I really know how I feel about it. But first impressions, pretty good.
So what's leading the pack Chuck Norris-wise right now?
Lone Wolf McQuaid.
Really?
Yeah.
Mm.
Well, look.
No, that's
look
fine.
Here. Look here now. I don't know. He's got that whole spaghetti western thing going on. I'm not going to say it's good because it's not good.
It's but it's one of his better movies. I just don't like it as much as some others. But
okay. Give me like a Chuck Norris top three.
I don't even think I mean, Code of Silence and Invasion USA. I don't know what number three might be. Lone Wolf McQuaid. I don't know. He does.
Well, you
not...
got Carradine. You got David Carradine. In
sure.
There, so.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
You've
and
got...
what's his name? Chakotay. Why can't I remember his name? Robert. Fuck. Keep talking.
Okay. Hey, I also watched Hellbound. No.
I've never seen Hellbound. That's like his sort of horror movie, right?
Yeah, you want to talk about a movie that fails to live up to the premise. Okay, so Chuck Norris versus the devil in 1994. Like, it starts in 1994 Chicago. So, again, should be great. There's, like, no Chicago in this movie. And then they go to Israel because it's a canon film. There is so little of anything in the movie. Like, it should be like slow motion fights of Chuck Norris and the devil. But it's just this like Michael Ironside lookalike guy with contact lenses, and they've pitched his voice down. I was really disappointed. Like,
that's the last canon film ever made.
Is it?
Yeah. Well, I knew it was like kind of on its last legs because it was came out in the early 90s, I think 94. And they were pretty much winding down by then, and that is the last film that they made. It's directed by Chuck's brother, Aaron.
That's right, who is a frequent director on Walker, Texas Ranger, and the director of Lone Wolf McQuaid.
All right, well, there you go. Robert Beltran, by the way, was the name that I was looking for. Star of Eating Raoul and Star Trek Voyager.
Yeah. Okay. I'm with you. Also, over Thanksgiving weekend, El Rey Network was playing The Way of the Turkey Marathon, which was just a bunch of kung fu movies. And so I caught a few that I hadn't seen before. I saw Five Fingers of Death, not four fingers, but Five Fingers of Death, which is the movie that we get the...
Right.
And then after that was Executioners from Shaolin, which is the movie that gives us Pai Mei, the beard, like, it's the guy from Kill Bill, like the long white haired with the long eyebrow guy.
Yeah.
Okay, so watching just those two movies brought something back that I've kind of been struggling with, and I feel like I should just come clean on the podcast, especially with you, because you are that, like, pizza is your favorite food, right? With Quentin Tarantino being your favorite director.
Right.
So, okay. When I'm watching these movies, these and old westerns and spaghetti westerns, I'm like, he's taken so much from these and put them in his own movies. Why don't I just watch these? Why, you know, why do I need to have it filtered and fed to me through this other thing when I can just watch this? And so that's a struggle that I'm kind of dealing with. And then I watch one of the Quentin Tarantino movies and I'm like, oh, this is why, because of the dialogue and because of the way everything's put together. And it kind of reminds me of, you're kind of a Bob Dylan fan, right? Like, you.
Yeah.
I don't know if you remember, but back in the early 2000s, he had an album called Love and Theft, where he, well, what we eventually found out was that he'd been taking his lyrics. Were things he'd been taking from books and like literature from like the last 100 years. And the only way people discovered it is like through a computer program. Someone just started typing in sentences, and then they discovered that all of these lyrics come from other things. And he'd just been, and they said plagiarism, and he wouldn't talk about it for a long time. And then his autobiography chronicles most of it. Like, I think the majority of the book is not even his words. He's taken them from other things and put them together. And then finally he did comment on it like 2006 or 2007 or something. And he said, look, you think it's easy to put that together in the way that I did? Like, I took what I wanted and I put it together in a way that made it, you know, I created a piece of art with these different pieces. And I feel like maybe that's kind of what Quentin Tarantino has done. And I should appreciate that. And I do appreciate that. But, I don't know. It's just something I've been thinking about. Is that crazy? Does that make any sense?
No, it makes sense.
You just want to hit me in the face, right?
No, not at all. I've had this conversation with people before who feel like he's nothing but kind of the summary of his influences, and I just don't agree because I think he does synthesize them into something that feels uniquely his own. You can certainly watch his movies and point to, this is a reference to this, this is a reference to this, this piece of music comes from this, this piece of music comes from this, the title comes from this, you know, I mean, all of his titles are kind of stolen from other things, not all, but a few are kind of stolen from other places. He's pretty upfront about it, you know, he's not trying to hide anything. If anything, he's kind of celebrating these movies that he loves and turning people on to them, which I think is great. I just happen to think that he synthesizes them in a really great way. And even though Kill Bill is a mashup of all these other movies, I happen to think that when you put them all together, it ends up feeling original. It doesn't just feel like a cover song. It's not just Family Guy where it's like, here's a reference to this, here's a reference to this. It's a lifetime of being obsessed with movies kind of exploding out of this one voice, you know, and that's how I see it. Other people don't agree. Other people are like, yeah, but there's nothing original there. It's just references to other things. I can't argue that with that person if that's their reaction to it. I just don't see it that way, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like what you said. I think that's it. I think he takes I like him a lot. I don't know that he's like, I don't know if I could name my top five directors, but I have a lot of respect for him, and his influences have become a lot of my influences too. And I think that he is able to take those things and create something that is different and also like marketable and something that people will watch where people will never watch some of this other stuff. No, he's pretty great. I'm not criticizing him, but I did want to just come clean about the struggle. So send all emails to Doug@ifthismovie.com.
Anything besides Chuck Norris and Kung Fu?
Yeah, that's about it. That pretty much covers it. A lot of exploitation stuff. Yeah. What about you?
Well, you know, again, it's the end of the year, so I'm trying to cram in all these films that I need to see / want to see. Sometimes it's one more than the other, mixed with a couple of exploitation movies myself. So
nice.
I saw Carol, which is the new film from Todd Haynes with Cate Blanchett and Rooney Mara. It's kind of like Far From Heaven, which he had made a couple years ago, without all of the kind of stylistic references to old Douglas Sirk melodramas. It's just a period romance about two women, basically. And it's incredible. I thought it was really just lovely and great, and tweeted out something when I was watching it because I kind of forget how much I love Todd Haynes. He makes movies so rarely. Every few years he comes out with one and I'm like, yeah, I got to see this movie because it's the new Todd Haynes. And then I'll see it and I'm blown away by it every single time. And for some reason I forget, oh, I really loved, you know, the last four. So why am I so surprised at how much I'm loving Carol? Like, I loved, speaking of Bob Dylan, I love I'm Not There. I love Velvet Goldmine, Safe and Poison and Far From Heaven, you know, I haven't seen the movie he made for HBO because I'm a bad person, but I've seen all the others and I love them all. And Carol is one of my favorite movies of the year. I know it's starting to pick up a lot of kind of year end awards from different critics groups. I'm sure it will be nominated for several Oscars. I have no idea how many it will win. But I thought it was really great and really worth seeing when it opens wide.
All right.
I also saw By the Sea, which is the movie written and directed by Angelina Jolie and starring herself and husband Brad Pitt as a couple kind of vacationing in France. Brad Pitt, Angelina Jolie is a mope, and that's the movie. It's 2 hours of ennui and nothing. And my jaw was open watching. It's very beautifully shot, and they are both attractive people. The scenery is great, but it to me, it felt like a movie with very little to say that takes a long time to say that thing. It's very influenced by a specific kind of European film from the 60s. And if you're a fan of some of those films, maybe you'll take something away from it. To me, it seemed crazy that they gave her $10 million to make this movie. It's only $10 million, which isn't huge. I was concerned. I actually looked up the budget watching it because I was like, please don't say that this is one of those things where like she spent $50 million of a studio's money to get a paid vacation. I admire the fact that she is branching out into directing and has stories that she wants to tell. She wrote the screenplay for this as well. That's all great. It just did not work for me really at all. Okay. I was not a fan at all. What else? I saw a couple other newer things that I won't talk about because I'd much rather talk about Close Range, which is the new Scott Adkins movie.
Ooh.
Directed by Isaac Florentine. It's available on VOD right now, and I was crazy excited about it and watched it with the intention of writing a heavy action column. And I don't think I will, because it turns out there's very little to say about the movie, unfortunately. Incredible opening. I don't think it's a spoiler to say, you know, Scott Adkins shows up at a building to rescue a girl who has been kidnapped, gets off an elevator, kills a bunch of people in a hallway all in one take. It's this amazing one take fight sequence. Goes back to like a farmhouse, and then the rest of the movie is just like an extended shootout at a farmhouse, which sounds great on paper, but it gets kind of dull. Like, I don't know. Maybe if I see it again now that I know that, like, oh, this is the extent of the story, maybe I'll enjoy it more as a Scott Adkins fan. I still liked the fighting. You know, Isaac Florentine is a really good action director because he lets play things out in long takes and, you know, pulls the camera way back so you can see head to toe, basically, the fights. And Scott Adkins is incredible. So if you're a fan of those two, you know, it's a good, it's an entertaining movie. I don't like it as much as like their last movie, which was Ninja Shadow of a Tear, or Ninja 2.
I believe it's Ninja Shadow of a Tear.
Oh, gosh. Yeah.
You know,
I feel foolish.
Hey, how does the fight scene compare, the one-shot fight scene compared to the one that Scott Adkins does in that Universal Soldier?
He's in Day of Reckoning. Which one? The sporting goods fight? The fight in the sporting goods store?
No, the one that's like, oh, it's been a while since it's like in a cave or something. And
oh yeah. That's pretty badass. It's pretty badass. And honestly, I think I might like John Hyams a little bit more as a director than I do Isaac Florentine, only because Isaac Florentine still has a tendency to shake the camera a little bit, and he goes for these weird angles, and all of his dramatic stuff feels like an alien made the movie. Like, anytime characters have to talk to each other or express character traits, it's like he's not from Earth.
So kind of like a Chuck Norris movie, right?
Maybe a little bit, yeah. But the fighting is cool, and if you're into that stuff, you can check it out. I think it's like $6. I think it comes out on Blu-ray in January, so you could probably wait a couple of weeks. My guess is it'll be on Netflix by February, so maybe just wait until I recommend it for Netflix, this movie, because there's nothing else to recommend, and Scott Adkins is in it. I watched Contraband, which just showed up on Full Moon Streaming, which is a gangster movie. It's Lucio Fulci kind of doing his version of The Godfather.
Okay.
Fabio Testi is in it. It's okay. You know, I wanted to like it more than I did. I'm always interested to see Fulci movies when he branches out from horror. He made a Western that I really like that JB had written about, the title of which I'm completely blanking out on right now, For the Apocalypse. And I really liked that movie. JB was not as much of a fan. So I'm always excited to see him cover something besides horror, because I know he started out doing comedy in Italy, and I've never seen any of his comedies, it's hard for me to imagine that he's a funny person, but maybe I'm wrong. Contraband works best when it goes crazy. I mean, there's a very famous shot of a guy getting shot in the head that's like unbelievably gory, and you're like, oh, there's Fulci. Otherwise, it's a little bit of a pale imitation of The Godfather. Even a character's brother is gunned down by, like, security. I mean, it's very reminiscent of James Caan in nice. The Godfather. So, an okay movie, but I felt a little bit disappointed, I think, just because I was so excited to finally be seeing it. And then the last movie that I'll talk about, I just saw for the first time. Somehow I'd gone my whole life without ever seeing Christmas Evil from 1980. A.K.A. You Better Watch Out, which nice. Is one of many Christmas horror movies. I still have been trying to watch Silent Night, Bloody Night, which I have. I think they're still doing it. Vinegar Syndrome, if you go to Vinegar Syndrome's website for like a nominal donation, I think it's like $2. You can download an HD copy of Silent Night, Bloody Night. And I keep putting it on right before going to bed, and then I fall asleep. So I've yet to make it more than about 20 minutes into that movie. And I know our friend Chaby had watched it during Junesploitation and really flipped out over it. So I really want to see it because I'm on kind of this Christmas horror movie kick, not just because of Krampus. So I was excited to finally see Christmas Evil. Christmas Evil starts great and crazy, and then gets super dull for like a really long time. And it's only about an 80-minute movie. And then the last 5 or 10 minutes make it all worth it. And you're like, oh, that's why I stuck around for this batshit ending. None of which I will spoil. But you will not be disappointed by the final few minutes of Christmas Evil. Hard to recommend. It's really only for those with a tolerance for kind of really slow, boring 80s exploitation or fans of Christmas horror films. But great beginning, great ending, kind of garbage middle.
Sounds interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. But that's it for me.
Okay.
You want to talk? Oh, let's talk about the... do you have any comments on the trailer for Batman v Superman Dawn of Justice?
I mean, I don't even know what to say. Like, I mean, I watched it, right? And it makes me sad. I know it gets some people excited. It makes me sad. It doesn't. And again, it's just a trailer, right? So I shouldn't have an opinion based on a trailer. But then again, that's what a trailer is for. It's to get you excited about seeing something. And it does not get me excited about seeing it. There is so much in that thing. And it looks so empty as far as like why we should care about any of it. And I don't want to blow my load on this Watchmen thing either, but like, so Man of Steel, I thought was fine, but some of the problem that I had with Man of Steel looks to have carried over to this movie, which is that it's very, picturesque in its images, and there's a lot of explosions and there's a lot going on, but there's not a lot of character at the heart of it. And again, it's just a trailer, so I don't know. But I did not think that there was a lot of heart at the center of Man of Steel either. I feel like the people that wrote the movie did not even know who Superman was before they made, you know, before they wrote it. What about you?
I have similar reactions. Of course, I'll see the movie, and like you, I recognize that it's only a trailer. I'm not someone who is actively rooting for the film to fail. I'm not like, I'm Team Marvel. I was not crazy about Man of Steel. That is well documented on this site. I'm rooting for Zack Snyder. I like the idea of Ben Affleck as Batman. Most of what I've been hearing every time they make a new announcement, I'm kind of like, and I'm not, you know, I don't think Jesse Eisenberg is the problem with the trailer. There was, you know, so many people on Twitter were like, it had me until Jesse Eisenberg. Like,
it really bothers me.
I don't love it. But again, you know, we're not seeing it in the context of a larger film. To me, that wasn't the problem. It's just everything I hear, I'm just like, are you sure you guys need to do all of that in one movie? You don't want to space it out a little bit? It just seems like fan fiction, you know, like we got to include everything we possibly can. And they're just putting so many eggs in this basket because they need to establish a universe right away. And instead of kind of building to it the way Marvel did, they're like, let's just get it out of the way right up front. Of course, I'll see the movie. But yeah, nothing in this trailer really inspired confidence, which is unfortunate because, again, I'm not rooting for the movie to fail, but the things that I saw in the trailer obviously aren't going to dissuade me from seeing it. I'm going to see it, but to me made it look almost actively bad. Zack Snyder still, like you said, has an eye for specific imagery, and there are shots here and there that I'm like, oh, that's really neat. You know, the shot of Superman walking down the hallway and all the people bowing to him, I still think is really interesting, or where he's kind of floating in the sky and all the people are looking up at him like he's the Messiah. Like, all that stuff to me is really interesting, but man, when you get that Wonder Woman reveal at the end, it just is embarrassing. To me, it's embarrassing and like the bad jokes. And I'm just, it seemed like a fan trailer.
Do you remember back in the day, like 2004, maybe 2005, there was this influx of like people who had made all these trailers, and there was a fan trailer movement was just getting steam, and we'd have like, I remember Grayson was one that hit a lot of people the right way, and it was about Dick Grayson like taking over, I think it was taking over the role of Batman or something. And then there was Batman versus Predator, which was like filmed by I don't know if he was like a second unit guy or something, but it was like people who had a little bit of talent and knew what they were doing, and they were making fan trailers for movies that would never be made. And so it was just everything, like the kitchen sink in these trailers. That's what this feels like to me.
Yeah, a little bit. And again, we'll see when it comes out in March, but it seems, you know, almost like Age of Ultron was, like, it's too big. It's too unwieldy. I don't know of a filmmaker who could rein all that shit in. But listen, maybe visionary director Zack Snyder is just the visionary to do it.
Well, and watching that trailer too, don't you just think like, oh, studios, like this is the studios. Like, how much of this is Snyder and how much of this is him just doing what he's told to do? Because, hey, this, I mean, I heard reports, I don't know if it's true, I heard reports, they were like, this needs more Batman. Go film more Batman. So that's what they did.
Yeah,
I like Ben Affleck. Well, I like the idea of Ben Affleck as Batman. I don't know that it seems so grim and gritty. I don't know that that's the direction I would have taken things. And I know that we don't want to compare Marvel to this, but people are saying like this trailer has levity. This one has levity. Like it looks like it's going to be funny. Like it doesn't. It's so grim.
It has
and
that
it's
awful
so, like,
joke at the end, which then is so at odds with the rest of the tone that, like, even if it was a funny joke, it would still feel weird because it does look so dark. And then at the end, they're making wisecracks about Wonder Woman. I don't know. We'll see. It comes out in March.
I'm sure we'll.
Yeah. I mean, I will too, of course, but we'll see. I don't know. I'm just kind of curious, really, you know, as kind of a jumping off point for our discussion of Watchmen, because now Zack Snyder has kind of become the superhero movie guy. Started, you know, his first comic book movie was 300, which a lot of people don't necessarily consider a comic book movie only because it's not about superheroes, right? But it's based on a very popular comic book. I'm not the world's biggest 300 fan. Are you?
I liked 300 when it came out. I thought it was really exciting and visually inventive and engaging, and then I didn't watch it again for like 5 years, and then when I watched it again, I was like, well, it's okay. And then I don't know that I've watched it since then, so maybe not. I don't know.
I don't think I've seen it since the night it opened, and I didn't love it when I saw it. I mean, it was obviously a very specific visual style that he was going for because he's a visionary, and now that has kind of defined his aesthetic going forward. Everything looks like a variation of 300. So then Watchmen was next. And with Watchmen, you know, he was trying to slay the dragon that no one had been able to slay. It was supposed to be an unfilmable movie. You know, Alan Moore obviously thinks so and was very vocal about that and refused to even have his name on the film, has said over and over, you know, I wrote it to be a comic book. We did things that you can only do in comic books. It's about being a comic book. It's not a storyboard, a series of storyboards for a film. You know, it's not designed to be cinematic. It's actually designed to be a comic book. And therefore, I don't think they should be making it into a film. And took his name off it. This was developed for years. In the 80s, we came close, I think late 80s, maybe early 90s. Maybe very early 90s. We came close to getting a Terry Gilliam Watchmen. Then Darren Aronofsky was going to make it in the early 2000s. Then he left to go finish or actually start making The Fountain. And then Paul Greengrass was going to make Watchmen. And all of them failed for one reason or another. And finally it lands on Zack Snyder's lap. And his approach seems to be, let's make this as much like the comic book as we possibly can. And that's kind of I feel like that's a fairly new phenomenon. That kind of started mm-hmm. with like Sin City, right? Where the approach is just, hey, let's use the frames and just reproduce those on screen. And then we're turning it from a comic book into a film. And I don't know how I feel about that. So I won't bury the lead. Obviously, we're going to be spoiling Watchmen again. If you haven't seen it, maybe tune out. Or if you don't care, keep listening. I won't bury the lead. I'm a big fan of Watchmen. I really like it.
That is not the direction I thought you were going.
Oh, okay. No, I really like it a lot. I still think it's Zack Snyder's best movie. It's as good a version of the comic that I could hope for, which isn't to say that it is a flawless film or that it gets everything right about the comic. For me, it's as good a version as I think we could have hoped for, which is not to say it doesn't have problems. It does. And one of those problems, I think, is that sometimes Snyder is so concerned with fidelity to the images from the pages, you know, Dave Gibbons' artwork, that he stops the movie to do it. He does a lot of speed ramping. That was something he started on 300 and mm-hmm. carries through Watchmen. And there are certain sequences that you want to move, and yet he slows them down, I think, as a way of saying, hey, remember this shot, remember this iconic image, and wants so much to reproduce the image from the comic that it's almost at the detriment of the film at times, not all the time. But I just talked for a long time. What are your feelings about Watchmen?
I forget in between my viewings of Watchmen how much I like it until I see it again. And then I'm like, oh, this is an amazing movie. And watching it, like, okay, so I knew that we were going to podcast about Watchmen. And I was not excited about watching. Now, I watched the 3-hour version. You watched the, what is it called? The Ultimate?
The Ultimate Cut, which runs over 3.5 hours.
It's the real-time version, right?
Yeah, basically.
Yeah. I was not excited about sitting down to watch this, the 3-hour, the director's cut is what I watched, which is 3 hours and 5 minutes. And I was dreading it. And then I watched like within 5 minutes when the Bob Dylan song kicks in, I was like, oh, that's right. This is a really good movie. And then it was like, it was okay. And then did not feel like 3 hours and 5 minutes to me. I like it a lot.
Yeah, I would. We did a show years ago about our favorite superhero movies, and I'm pretty sure I put this in my top 10, possibly even my top 5, and I would keep it there. I think it's a pretty terrific movie, and I don't know if the theatrical cut is even available on Blu-ray. I don't feel like it is. I feel like only the director's cut is, and then the ultimate cut.
I think you're right. Yeah,
and the ultimate cut now, I think, is pretty widely available, but it was one of those things that like came out very quickly, went out of print immediately, was going for crazy amounts of money on eBay, and I just happened across one day Warner Brothers, you know, their website like was dumping the remaining stock, and so I was able to snag a copy. And then, you know, a year later, I think it was reissued and is now pretty widely available. The major difference with the ultimate cut, honestly, is that they edit back in the Tales of the Black Freighter animated stuff, mm-hmm. which was originally made for the film, and then they took it out, and so it was available as a separate release. You could get Tales of the Black Freighter and Under the Hood, which is kind of produced as like a news magazine show, instead of excerpts from Night Owl's, you know, autobiography or whatever.
Right.
It's interesting to watch it that way with the animated stuff cut back in. It's like a neat experiment. I don't know how often I would return to the ultimate cut. I mean, it's so long. I think the director's cut is probably the best version. And I like the theatrical cut too. So when the theatrical cut came out, I saw this movie probably 3 or 4 times.
Wow.
Theatrically. And honestly, the big reason I saw it opening day, really liked it. The big reason was this was right when IMAX screens started popping up in a lot of places. And so this was one of the first movies to really start showing in IMAX. And that was why I kept going, because it is such a visual movie, and it was kind of a revelation to see it in that format on such a gigantic screen with that sound system. So I saw it a couple times, mostly just knowing I will never have this experience. You know, same with like when I was going to see Grindhouse over and over again, it was like, I'll never have this experience again. So I saw it a couple times theatrically, and then had seen the director's cut a few times on Blu-ray. And this was really my first time ever watching the ultimate cut. And like I said, I don't know that I would keep going back to it, because I don't think the Tales of the Black Freighter stuff works. That's one of those things that Alan Moore, I think, is talking about, where that works on the comic book page, in terms of how it relates to the larger story.
Mm-hmm.
But cutting it in as kind of an animated sequence, recreating what the kid at the newsstand is reading, like I said, it's interesting, but it doesn't totally work cinematically, I don't think.
Now, does the ultimate edition that you have also have the director's cut on it?
It does not. I held on to that Blu-ray. It does come with the complete motion comic.
Yeah.
Which I've never put in.
No, I don't understand motion comics. It's like for people that want to read but won't. They're like, I want this read to me on a screen. I don't know.
And my understanding is that the motion comic, all of the voice work is done by one male narrator.
Yeah, it's one guy. I used to have that Blu-ray, I think, and I sold it because I watched it once. And I was like, I will never watch this again. I will read Watchmen.
Yeah, I'll just read it.
All right. I mean, and it's a commitment, granted. Like, but I think that Blu-ray, too, is like, it's hours and hours long because it's not condensed, I don't think.
No, because I believe it says the complete motion comic.
Yeah, it's so... Just read it.
Right.
Just read it,
It's
man.
The same time commitment, and you can do different voices in your head.
It's less of a time commitment because you can go faster than this guy. Let's see. Okay, so I have Watchmen right by me. So you can go faster than some guy going like, his full name is Walter Joseph Kovacs, born 19... They can go faster than that. No. Read a book.
Where do we start talking about this? Yeah.
It should be this good though, right? Like, it's
well,
like...
listen, we are not, I won't say alone, but there are plenty of people who really dislike this movie for a lot of reasons. Some because they don't think it works as a movie. It's designed to just be a comic book. Some because they feel it's too literal. Doesn't change enough. Some because it changes too much, because it alters most significantly the ending. There's no giant squid. Some dislike it because of Zack Snyder's choices. The speed ramping, the slow motion sex scene set to Leonard Cohen, the on the nose musical choices. And I can't disagree with some of those. The music choices are very on the nose. The slow motion sex scene is kind of comical. And here's the weird thing, because when I saw Watchmen a couple times in the theater, I really liked it, and I don't feel like I was making excuses for Zack Snyder, but I was drawing my own interpretations of things that he was doing. Mm-hmm. And one of those things that I felt like he was doing was, as much as Watchmen the comic is about being a comic book and is about other comic books, other superhero comic books. I felt like Watchmen the movie was about being a superhero movie and was a comment and a reflection of other superhero movies, which is why Adrian Veidt kind of looks like a Joel Schumacher superhero, you know, which is why even in the marketing, you know, they used that Smashing Pumpkins song, The End is the Beginning is the End, or whatever it's called, that right. was used in the marketing of Batman and Robin. So it's reminding you of these other, you know, arguably lesser superhero movies. And so when we get to the slow motion sex scene, I felt like that was kind of a comment on movie sex and about it's so much about superhero sex, you know, in a stylized way. But I'm pretty sure I've said this on the podcast before, but I don't feel like you can watch that shot of the camera starting at the bottom of Malin Ackerman's boot and like mm-hmm. going all the way up her superhero boot and say that that scene is about anything but like, here's how superheroes fuck, which I think is great. I understand yeah. that some people found it comical, but like, you don't see that in movies, you know, in these other superhero movies. They're not interested in like, here's how they have sex. If you didn't like the music choice, if you didn't like the slow motion, okay, that stuff didn't bother me. But here's the problem, because then I did the same thing for Sucker Punch. I see Sucker Punch and I read all these things into it and I'm like, yeah, I think he's doing this and this and this, and I actually think it's a really smart movie, you know, disguising itself as a really stupid one,
right?
And then I listen to his commentary and it's like, oh no, that's not the movie he was making. He was kind of making the dumb one, and I'm giving him too much credit. So sometimes the things that I read into Watchmen, I think I might be giving him too much credit for doing. Now,
yeah,
does that make it, that doesn't make it a worse movie, because it's all, you know, it's all our reactions to it. And so the way that I assign meaning to it is the way that I assign meaning to it. And just whether or not that's what he intended, you know, it doesn't take anything away. But I watch it and I'm like, oh, yeah, he really knows what he's doing. And sometimes I think he stumbles upon some great things a little bit by accident.
Wow. OK, this is trippy. All right. OK, so I agree with you. I actually agree with your take of the movie too. I think that a lot of the stuff that's in there is a comment on that thing, as the book is a comment on those things. Like, have you read Watchmen?
And it's fine if you haven't. Okay. A couple times. Yeah.
You know, like, it's okay. So it's one of the top three most well-respected miniseries, like comic book series ever. Probably
it would be that and Dark Knight Returns and
maybe Killing Joke.
Oh yeah. Wow. Alan Moore's got two of the three.
Yeah.
And two of the three are Batman stories. What's up with that?
Well, that's just my understanding. Somebody else might be like, well, but there's what, Love and Rockets, and but those aren't so
maybe you've stories. Never read the Clone Saga from Spider-Man?
Oh, no, that's it. You're right. With Ben Reilly, right? Yeah. No, I'm with you. Number one, baby. Number one. I think that Watchmen has a lot of the stuff built into it, but he does. Okay, all along the watchtower plays as they're walking towards the stronghold of the bad guy, and it is on the nose, but I think that it knows it's on the nose. And also, even if it's not, I kind of don't care, because I like it there, and I think that it's saying something interesting while, oh man, now I don't know. See, the Sucker Punch thing throws me, because I don't know that commentary. So is it possible it's an ironic commentary and he's...
I don't think so.
Okay.
I don't think so.
I think he knows what he's doing in this movie, because there's so many things. Like, this movie has such a deep understanding of who these characters are. And that is in the book. But so many movies lose everything that makes these characters interesting during the adaptation process. And, you know, I'm a big stickler for adaptation. Like, especially where we live in a climate where... a movie climate where everything is taken from something else. Like, okay, I'm an 80s cartoon fan, right? We have a gym movie that throws the entire premise of the 80s cartoon out the window. And it's just like, let's make it like, you know, like a Disney show where, you know, she just like, doesn't, appreciate her friends and kind of gets too big of a head. Like, that's not what that's about. You fail completely in your adaptation of taking this thing and keeping the essence of what it is as you translate it to this other medium. And so many movies do not keep what makes the characters and the premise and the story interesting. Watchmen gets all of it to me. Like, all these characters feel so deep and real and lived in. And I don't even feel like it takes a side either. Like, Rorschach is like the militant Republican guy, but it's not saying that he's wrong. It just presents his point of view. And then we have other people who are, you know, liberal people who are very, it's not saying, well, this is right and this is wrong. It's just presenting all these different people with all their different points of view and letting the story play out. And he gets that and he brings it to the screen. So he must understand on some level.
Well, again,
back to you,
Patrick. I don't know. I think he does too. I mean, I don't think he's a dummy. You know, I don't think all of this happens by accident. He's often accused of being worried, more about style over substance. And maybe he benefits from the fact that his substance here is Watchmen, and it's a pretty literal translation of Watchmen. So a lot of that work has been done for him. And so what he has to do is find a way to make these things visual, serve that story. And I think in doing so is where he kind of finds ways to, again, comment on the superhero movie. And it's actually, a few years ahead of its time, because the superhero movie as we know it has almost blown up since then. There were certainly a handful, but Marvel had really, I think, only released two films at that point.
Yeah.
Iron Man and Incredible Hulk, I think, were the only two that had come out by the time Watchmen was made.
Right.
So we're in a climate now where there are a lot more superhero movies that are coming out. And so Watchmen was a little bit ahead of its time. And I honestly, when I saw it, I was sure that it was a movie that was going to be a movie that was ahead of its time and that was going to be appreciated 10 or 20 years down the line. I still don't, that still is a possibility, but it feels much less likely now. It hasn't made the cultural impact that I hoped it might. Now, listen, some people may look back on it once this wave of superhero movies has kind of died down. Somebody may reflect on the entire genre and say, oh, but here's this one thing that kind of stands out and that was saying something that these other movies weren't and that was doing something that these other movies weren't. And maybe then it will gain some appreciation, but it seems to have kind of come and gone. Which I don't know. I think I expected more of a life for it because the comic series is so enduring. And people are still buying it and reading it for the first time. It still has the reputation of being arguably the greatest comic series ever written. I didn't read any of Watchmen Origins. Is that what it was called?
Yeah.
Did you read any of it?
No.
All right. So
it's diminishing returns. I mean, I can't say that because I haven't read it, but my feeling about it is that there is nothing that can be added to this that would make me appreciate Watchmen more, and it will only detract from the experience that I already have. So no, I did not read it.
Yeah, it didn't really. This doesn't seem like a story that cries out to go back to. It's not. We can't have a universe here. We can't have a franchise. It's a closed loop.
Did you read it?
No, I didn't. Okay. But for that reason, I just was like. For the same reason as you, there's not more story to tell here. I don't think,
No, and it was such a product of its time too, that going back 28 years later, however long it was.
Yeah.
I don't understand how you can't even have the same tone because the world has moved on so much since then.
So do you think that the movie loses anything in translation by coming out in 2009? I mean, it's still set in the 80s.
Yeah. I think that's what people might be thrown by, possibly, that it's an alternate. Do they give a year? Is it 86, 80s? I don't remember if they do or not. But we have Nixon in his fifth term, right? So Yeah. I don't know. People can't identify with it, so it's just out there on its own. Maybe. It might have lost something by sticking to that timeline.
I don't know, because again, it's all about this fear of destruction, right? Yeah. And in the 80s, it's kind of talking about war with the Russians or whatever. You know, we're all worried about that. And by 2009, I mean, the enemy had changed, but we're all still afraid of being attacked and blown up all the time. So to me, it still works, you know, which is sad that, like, that theme is universal, because you can, yeah, you know, do it 20 years later and it still applies. It's just the enemy has a different face, or the person, you know, who wants to kill us has a different face.
No, you talked me into it.
I lost it. I was going to say something, and now I had something to say about, like, moving it, you know, 20 years later or whatever, and now I lost it.
I don't see how you could have, though, because the whole story is rooted in, you'd have to change everything about it. You'd have to change
there were versions of the script early, you know, there were many attempts made at writing a screenplay, and there were versions of the screenplay that were not set in the 1980s. Oh, that's what I was going to say. The theatrical cut, honestly, one of the detriments of the theatrical cut, and I don't remember the exact changes, but remind me, does the director's cut include all the stuff with the guy at the newsstand and the kid?
No.
It doesn't.
There's a scene, and I can think of one scene where there's a kid reading The Black Freighter, but I can't think of any other.
It doesn't cut back to them regularly?
I don't think so.
My memory...
But you know what? You're talking about that, and I feel like I've seen that.
Yeah. My memory was that it had, but maybe I'm wrong. Yes. Because that was always one of the issues with me of the theatrical cut, is that it doesn't give this sense of impending doom and imminent destruction that the comic book certainly conveys, and that I think is slightly better conveyed in, I thought, the director's cut, and certainly in the ultimate cut. So much of the film in the theatrical cut is told solely from the point of view of the heroes, you know, the Minutemen or the Watchmen, whatever you want to call them. Right. And they talk a lot about, like, hey, the world's going to be blown up any minute. But you don't get that sense of panic that's happening in the streets of New York. And one of the things that the ultimate cut, and like I said, I thought the director's cut restores, is the guy at the newsstand and the kid, who are kind of the proxies for all the citizens of New York, you know, and there's a little bit more of that sense of, like, the world feels like it's going to end. And that's one of the problems, I think, with the translation. Again, I still really like the film, but when Veidt's plan is revealed at the end, it's like, this seems like a very drastic measure for a problem you haven't effectively established. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I do. I wonder, they did change the ending. I guess they changed the method of the ending, so they didn't actually change the cause of the ending.
The intent, I don't remember, right?
Right, yeah. I don't remember exactly how it played out in the comic book. Is it established well in the comic book? Or do you remember?
That everyone feels like the world is going to end?
No, do they establish why Veidt is doing what he's doing?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, right. Much more so. And again, it's a thread that runs through the whole thing, because you have him take, you know, the artist drawing the squid, and then the building of the squid, and then he teleports in the squid. And that's the moment that the film is kind of missing, where you get in the comic book, you get those splash pages after the squid appears and everyone's, you know, brains basically melt out of fear. I totally understand why it was changed for the film. And I actually think it's a change for the better. For the story that they are telling, I think the squid thing works in the comic. I don't think they could have done it in the film. And I know this is one of the people's objections, is that it's so literal. And then you get to the end and you change one of the most significant elements of the story. So why be so literal, but only to a point? And I just don't think they could have, you know, again, they're asking us to buy A, B, and C. And I think asking us to also buy D would have been a bridge too far. It would have been a little bit too much. So I understand why they changed it. And again, by making it into Dr. Manhattan, I think it works for the story that they are telling. But when you get to that in the comic after the squid appears and you get those pages of just mass death, that moment is missing from the film. And again, that it speaks to the drastic measures that Veidt is taking and sort of the why of it all. And the movie never quite communicates that as well.
I wonder if they took that out because of the world that we live in. What if it would have just been too much?
Because like very, very few giant squids, you mean? Like, where do you even find a squid that big, you know? And then where do you find one that can teleport?
Well, all valid points. But I was referring to like just the mass slaughter.
Not wanting to show all the dead bodies.
Not wanting to show all the dead bodies.
Weirdly enough, he chose to do it in his Superman film.
Yeah, well.
might have been more appropriate in Watchmen.
I was going to say, though, even in a Superman movie, a lot of it's just we don't see the faces of it. We just see the buildings, which is, again, we're taking the action and we're removing the consequence from it. But
it's off screen, yeah.
That's something else. Where were we? I don't even remember where we were.
Well, we kind of talked about the squid. I know there was one version of the screenplay. I think it was like the Sam Hamm version because he had written Batman. So, hey, we want to write a new comic book movie. Let's get the guy who wrote Batman. His solution was to have Veidt travel back in time and kill Dr. Manhattan before the accident. So he never becomes Dr. Manhattan, which means we never win Vietnam, which means Nixon is never reelected. He kind of loopers it, you know, like he puts a stop to it before any of it happens. Again, an interesting approach. I don't think it's a better one, but I understand the rationale behind it.
I'm kind of fine with the way it is now, honestly. I mean, I gotta be honest, like that, I kind of like the way that it is in the movie.
I like I like the one that he used for the movie. I like it for the movie.
And that's going back to, I want to be clear, my adaptation thing, I believe that you should change things that need to be changed. And this movie changes things that need to be changed. You should never be a slave to source material. And in most instances for things that aren't Watchmen, like I've read the storyline for something like Civil War is coming out, you know, like this Captain America Civil War movie. Well, I read Civil War. And the book that I read does not really seem to be the movie that they've made. It has cues from it. They've used it as a jumping off point for something that's new and its own thing. And I think that's really wise most of the time because you don't want to become the slave to your source material. But at the same time, you want to keep what it is that you're adapting and not lose the heart and the soul of it. And I've lost myself again. I don't even know why I started talking about that in the first place. But so I feel like Watchmen changes. That's all I was going to say is I feel like Watchmen changes things that need to be changed for the better. They're good decisions, I believe. And it leaves so much alone and translates so much in a pure form that it retains like all of the importance of the story. Like it feels like such an important story to me. Maybe the best comic book movie that's ever been made. I'll stick with that. I think Watchmen has probably done it better than anything else could for a superhero story. It's such a deconstruction. I don't even know where you go from there. Back to you. The biggest deconstruction of all time.
Right, it is. But and then you said, where do you go from there? And the truth is, it's mostly just ignored. You know, it's like it comes out and you almost expect it to be, which is exactly what happened with the comic book. When Alan Moore wrote it, he kind of expected it to be the last word on superhero comics. And yet, here we are in 2015 and superhero movies are bigger than ever. I mean, comics are still big, but like this comes out and you kind of expect it to be the end of the superhero trend, not really still kind of the infancy, because now they're even bigger than they were in 2009 when this movie was made. So as much as it deconstructs, people generally just kind of ignore it. I mean, here's a movie that says, hey, they're all fascists, and everyone's like, one, please. You know, these movies are the biggest grossing movies for the most part, if only they would put dinosaurs in them, every year. And so it's surprising. You had mentioned earlier on you were rewatching it and you got to the opening credits and you were reminded how much you love the movie. And yes, I feel like even people who didn't love the movie point to the opening credits and say, okay, but those are amazing. And again, you want to talk about visual storytelling. You want to talk about condensing exposition down to just a series of images. I think the movie has some of the best, and maybe this sounds hyperbolic, I don't know, some of the best opening credits of all time.
There's a whole movie in those credits. And maybe that's what the Watchmen Origins thing is. Like, maybe we should read that. Maybe that's what happens in those credits. I don't know. But it does. It takes, like, it covers years. I don't even know how many years. But, like, there's so much there. And it does it in the breadth of, like, 4 minutes or whatever. And it feels so important. And you're just like, it is so gorgeous. But also, like, upsetting and tragic. And, oh, it's... I'm going to go watch it right now. I'll be right back.
And you watch The Watchmen. The two images that in that sequence that kind of don't work for me are the ones that are more interested on advancing the story on a micro level. And they almost don't make sense unless you've read the comic. There's the one of the prostitute and the little red haired boy. And there's the one of Silk Spectre's parents fighting, basically. And they don't stand out. You don't even understand. You know, if you haven't seen the movie yet, you're just seeing this little red-haired kid. Like, you're not going to file that away in your memory and be like, oh, that's Walter Kovacs or whatever.
Listen, can we play? They prefer to be called Gingers.
I'm sorry, Gingers. That's Walter Kovacs. You know, you don't understand who these parents are that are fighting because they stand out so much from when you're comparing it to, like, here's the Kennedy assassination, you know, here's these two. And again, I love the way that it kind of twists certain iconography. So instead of the sailor kissing the girl in the street, you get what's her name kissing the girl in the street, you know, and these are huge iconic images and tell a story on a big level. Here's what's happening in the country. And then it tries to throw in a little detail about, like, oh, yeah, and a little red-haired boy saw his mom be a prostitute. Like, I almost feel like those should have come out, you know, because they almost stand out too much. And you're like, wait, what? Why'd you just show me? You went from Kennedy being shot to that? Like, who are these people? Again, nitpick, sure, because it's an amazing opening credit sequence. And that's the thing. You know, I understand people not liking the movie. I'm not trying to convince anyone, like, you should love it, but I really like it, and here's why, you know, basically. I think even if you don't love the movie, hopefully you can at least concede that there are multiple set pieces in the film that are amazing, you know. That opening credits scene is really, really great. I like most of the comedian's funeral, but even if you don't love that, you have to at least hopefully be a sucker for the Ride of the Valkyries, Dr. Manhattan zapping the soldiers in Vietnam. I mean, that image is so powerful. The whole Dr. Manhattan on the planet origin sequence with the Philip Glass music. I mean, that's incredible stuff. I like the prison break. I know a lot of people don't because they feel like Snyder went too far with the violence.
What?
Yeah, no, that was a complaint at the time, that it was so unnecessarily gory and violent. And again, I always kind of liked that because I felt like, you know, we've gone from the Batman TV show where it's like cartoon bubbles that say bam, biff, pow. And now, like, no, we're going to show you what this really looks like. I mean, again, it's in a very stylized movie kind of a way. It's not like he's trying to show you honest violence, but
But it's showing you what that is in this.
It goes all in on the violence, you know, as opposed to pulling back and just making a pow, boom, biff.
Yeah, just like you said, this is how superheroes have sex. This is everything this movie does is committing to the world that is created. This is how these people. This is how the violence plays out. I mean, the scene where Jackie Earl Haley goes to that guy's house that has the dogs, and he's with the cleaver or whatever. Oh man.
And now in the director's cut, does he just whack him once?
No, there's a few.
I feel like that's a change, too. I don't remember that from the theatrical cut where he really hacks him a few times. And somebody could say, no, you're wrong, because I remember this. My memory was that it was like just once in the theatrical and a bunch in the director's. I could be wrong about that.
No, I think you're right.
That's all I wanted to hear.
Yeah, yeah, no, you're right. I call you sometimes. It's like bleep, bleep. You
know, let's talk about the cast, because I followed this very closely as they were announcing casting and they were introducing, you know, the first images of the cast in their costumes. And I was, as they were announced, largely underwhelmed.
Really?
As they were announced, yes. Yeah, not after I saw the movie. Do you
remember who let you down the most? Was there one big surprise? You were like, what?
Not in like an incredulous way. I mean, Jackie Earl Haley was the one that I was the most bored with. Yeah. It was like, yeah, that one they got right.
Like that kid from Bad News Bears.
Everything else, I felt like they'd gotten the B team. And looking back on it, they did the right thing because they didn't cast a bunch of big movie stars who would have brought their own baggage, with one exception, and I'll talk about that in a second, who would have brought their own baggage to the film. You know, they hired actors who are good actors, who are recognizable actors, to come in and do the job. And after seeing the movie, I was more or less happy with everyone. You know, I thought everyone did a good job. But at the time, I remember feeling like, I don't know. I feel like they're getting all JV people. I think Jeffrey Dean Morgan, I was like on board with, cause I could see that. And I mean, I like Patrick Wilson, but he just felt kind of generic, but he's supposed to be, you know,
exactly.
He's right. Yeah. Malin Ackerman, I don't know. I think maybe I wanted Silk Spectre to pop a little bit more. And I know people have some issues with her performance, that she's just kind of bland and whiny. And to a large extent, that's the character.
Right.
I feel like it's actually even more the character in the comic. I don't think she gives the strongest performance in the film, but maybe I'm just upset at her bad wig. Because she is a good actor, as anyone who has seen The Final Girls can attest. She's really, really great in that movie. The big sticking point for me remains Matthew Good as Adrian Veidt or Ozymandias. I don't particularly like his performance. I think he's miscast. I don't really like the sort of weirdly fey Germanic accent that he's doing. I think he telegraphs everything. Like, I think he draws so much attention to himself as being the villain of the thing, even though he's sort of not the villain of the thing, depending on how you look at it. I just think there are too many like shots of him glaring or looking suspicious. It's like, if you wanted this to be a reveal, it's not. There are neon signs that say Veidt did it. And part of me, I know, is still a little bit brokenhearted because, and I may have talked about this before, at one point it was discussed that Tom Cruise would play Adrian Veidt. And that is the greatest casting ever.
I would have hated that.
For real?
Yeah, I would not have been able to separate, unless he's basically playing himself, which he might kind
that's
of have
the
been.
Genius of it. I mean, that's 100% the... You don't have any movie stars, and then you get Tom Cruise to play the, you know, the movie star superhero, and then you flip the whole thing on its head by making him the villain. I mean, to me, that was like such inspired casting. And so to go from Tom Cruise, who brings so much of his own baggage to the movie's benefit, I think in that case, to Matthew Good, who to me just barely registers, was a bummer.
You present an interesting case here. So this is why you should be working in Hollywood. You need to be putting things
they
like this
never
together.
Call me.
How do you feel? It's just like tangent. How do you feel about Tom Cruise in Tropic Thunder?
Not a fan.
Okay. Well, okay, good. That's exactly how I feel. So I find it so distracting and so just like
it's just too pleased with itself. Like
ostentatious.
Yeah, it's fine for one or two scenes. If you want to bury him under makeup and have him swear and shout, like, I'm fine with that. It's just that the movie, like, at some point they just fell so in love with it. They're like, we got to get him in here more. And so he's dancing and it just becomes self-indulgent. I don't hate it on its face. I'm just not crazy about it.
Well, once you hire Tom Cruise to be your bad guy in your movie, he just does what he wants to do. And you got to understand this. So he's going to show up. He's going to be like, I'm going to do this. He's going to ride up on his motorcycle. He's going to be like, I know you want me to do this, but I'm going to do it this way. Like, no, no, wait a minute. That's not what we want. And he's going to just like smile at you and like shoot you the finger. And then he just does whatever he wants to do. And then you get what you get.
I don't know. Most times it works.
it does, doesn't it?
I'm a fan of Billy Crudup's performance as well. At one point, I know there was talk about Keanu Reeves playing Dr. Manhattan, which I think could also have worked. I don't know for sure, because one of the things that I love about Billy Crudup is his vocal delivery and how soft it is and kind of flat. And I love the way that his voiceover is mixed and all the other sound is dropped out, you know. And I don't know that I could have heard Keanu Reeves doing that voiceover or the narration in quite the same way. But I like that the idea that, you know, Keanu Reeves is already sort of like from another planet, you know, and so to have him play Dr. Manhattan kind of makes sense. But Billy Crudup would not have been a choice that came to mind when they were thinking of who to cast. But I like what he does in the part.
Yeah, I can't separate myself from what I've seen now, but he embodies it so well. It's the voice, which is what you said. But I mean, also, I don't know anybody else who has such a gorgeous big blue penis.
That was another thing that was brought up so much at the time, where it was just like,
yeah,
I don't know. It
offended people. It really bothered people.
If that's what you're seeing in the movie, like, how does the movie ever stand a chance at working? You know what I mean? Like, if you're so distracted by a CGI dick, like, of course you're not going to like the movie. Why would you? Because you're focused on the wrong things.
Yeah, and yet, like, 50% of all of us are walking around with one, and we see it every day. Like, what's the big deal?
Wait, you have a big blue CGI dick, too?
Yeah.
Okay.
Do you not?
No, I do. I've always felt so alone.
We all do.
So
we
this
all
makes
do.
Me feel better. I keep mine in my
we
pocket.
We all do.
I think it's interesting that, like, they planned to do this movie, you know, in the early 90s, because how would they have achieved so many of the effects, including Rorschach's mask, including all of Dr. Manhattan? Would it have just been, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger as Mr. Freeze, like a built dude is slathered in blue paint?
I have to think so. And he'd have like black bicycle shorts on the whole time.
Because the effect is really cool.
Yeah. Absolutely.
The effect that they landed on, you know.
His penis, right. No, it's really, it's fantastic.
That big blue dong. So I watch the movie and I have the sound turned way up because the sound design is really cool. And I mean, there's just image after image. And I recognize that so many of them come from the comic. I know that. So I'm not giving Zack Snyder, he is a visionary, but I'm not giving him all the credit. I know that he's oftentimes just translating iconic images from the comic, but he's good at that. You know, he's good at creating really powerful images inside of a film that still moves and is essentially an action movie. You know, this movie doesn't have a ton of action, but that's impressive, because that, you know, a lot of times when we think about filmmakers who do that, we don't often think of it necessarily in this kind of a framework. We think of it more of like a Terrence Malick film, or certainly, you know, Spielberg became known for that, or Stanley Kubrick, and I'm not necessarily comparing Zack Snyder to those filmmakers. I'm just saying, inside of this comic book superhero action movie, I mean, he comes up with these really striking, really powerful images, and maybe that's just me being on board for the movie, and so just kind of being drunk in like what I like about it, and really responding to those things. Because again, if you're not a fan of the film, none of that adds up. You know, maybe that doesn't work on a narrative level. You can point to like, oh yeah, cool shot, cool shot, cool shot. But if it doesn't add up to anything, what difference does it make? For me, it adds up.
No, there's a lot of cool shots. Can you think of one that is your favorite? Like, is there one that you're thinking of right now?
There's not, honestly.
Okay. Well, I love the image. I love the Vietnam image of Dr. Manhattan just like stalking into the frame as he blasts the people running toward camera. That's one of my favorites.
And again, I recognize that the I don't mean to interrupt, but I recognize that the music cue is on the nose, right? But I do think it speaks to what we were saying about Zack Snyder using this as a movie that is commenting on other movies. It's not commenting on comic books the way that the comic book does. So he's using movie shorthand, right? So we're in Vietnam. Right. What's the shorthand? What's the quickest way to kind of signify Vietnam? Well, let's use this famous piece of music that was used in Apocalypse Now, you know, and immediately we understand the reference. And so we understand not only, okay, we're in Vietnam, but it's also, it becomes, he's subverting the Vietnam film, you know, and Coppola was kind of already doing that in Apocalypse Now, but he's doing it now even more by giving us a giant blue weapon that's basically saying like, yeah, not only in this alternate timeline do we win Vietnam, but we do so essentially by cheating as much as one can cheat in a war. You know, we have a weapon that no one else has, and therefore it's not even like it's not a fair fight.
Yeah, you said that so well. There's actually nothing that I can add to that, but I will say what you said, and again, I will just like repeat what you said in that. What he does is he takes the tropes and the genres, like the tropes of genres like the war film, and then inserts Watchmen into something that we know already so well, and then it becomes subversive because of what he just did, which is what you just said, but I have to say something, so that's what I'm saying. It's fantastic, and I do think he's aware of it, and I think that this movie is incredibly well-crafted, and it's full of things like that.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. Yeah. I think, one of the... Watching it this time, some of the problems stood out to me, maybe more than in the past.
I'm liking this movie more than I've ever liked it.
It's not a macro problem, but like there are some. It's not a subtle movie, you know. For as much as some of these subversions, or I won't say the references are subtle, but what he's using the references for sometimes can be subtle. You know, the costuming of Ozymandias being kind of a reference to Schumacher. Some of that stuff is subtle, but Zack Snyder is not a subtle filmmaker, and that's okay. Right. Oh, I wanted to say earlier that I think it's weird when we were talking about how this movie you would think would kind of have come at the end of the superhero movie cycle, the way that like Heathers came at the end of the teen movie cycle. It was the final word, you know, on teen movies until the next wave of teen movies 10 years later. But you would expect Watchmen to kind of be the final word, right? And instead, it's Snyder's almost opening statement on the genre. And now he's essentially bought into the system that he was kind of deconstructing with Watchmen. You know, now he's making movies that are essentially the adventures of Ozymandias and Night Owl, you know, instead of,
right. And there's nowhere to go, right? Because, you know, the reason, so the comic book, Alan Moore wanted to use, what was the company? I can't even remember. He wanted to use established characters.
Yeah, real characters. I remember. I don't remember the company either. But
and they were like, if you do this, we can never use those characters again. So here, use these. It was on the tip of my tongue. Anyway, so like, Rorschach is the Question. He couldn't use the Question, so they like, you know, create this other version of that. The Owl is basically Blue Beetle. They did that because once you've told the story, there's really nowhere else to go. And I feel like this movie does it so well. It deconstructs these characters so well. And I mean, like Nolan had done it too, some of the Batman movies. But I feel like we're at a point where we've deconstructed these heroes as low as they can go. Like we have taken them apart and we've got all these pieces on the floor, but we're still making movies with them. We don't do this. Like Marvel doesn't do this. And I'm not going to get into a versus thing, but Marvel doesn't really deconstruct. They just have adventures based on character. But these DC movies continually like pick these things apart and like, well, this makes him tick because this, and like this is built into why he is who he is. And we just continue to pick them apart and pick them apart and pick them apart. And unless we put them back together again, I don't know where we're going to go. But yet we have all these movies that keep coming out where they're continuing to tear them apart. And this Superman, or what is it? Batman versus whatever it's called. It looks like it's doing the
Batman
same thing.
Batman v Superman Dawn of Justice.
Well done. It looks like it's still taking them apart. And I don't know how you do that. I don't know where there is left to go.
Yeah. I mean, once you keep breaking them down, then of course it is hard to just do adventures, you know? And I mean, I'm super interested in that idea of kind of deconstruction of superhero movies, and let's make a Superman movie that's about what it means to be Superman. You know, I don't think he was really successful with Man of Steel, but I like the idea. Charlton Comics, is that what you were looking for?
That's it. Okay. Yes.
Yeah. I looked it up. I'm not smart.
You shouldn't have told me that. Furthermore, you are, and you're right. Furthermore, Alan Moore, with the Killing Joke, I think that he believed he was telling the last Joker story. And, like, that's how he wrote it, and that's how he published it. You know, that's what it was intended to be, is the final Batman versus the Joker story. And then, you know, you can't just stop. So here we are.
Let me ask you a question about the Killing Joke.
Okay.
Because I just recently, online somewhere, somebody advanced the theory, it's so obvious that Batman kills the Joker at the end of that.
Yeah, that comes from Grant Morrison was talking to Kevin Smith. Kevin Smith was interviewing the author, the writer Grant Morrison, and Grant Morrison said, "Isn't this how everyone sees it?" And I never saw it that way, but
didn't either. I was so confused by that.
But having gone back, like if you look at it now that I hear that and with that in my head, I can't see it any other way. It does seem very obvious. Like it,
really.
Have you looked at it since then?
I thought so.
Well, it's meant to be up in the air. Like it's not, it's all off panel. So you don't see anything. It's meant to be.
Well, so how do you
open to interpretation? But what?
If it's all off panel, how do you know?
Okay, spoilers for the Killing Joke. So I'm looking at it across. It's like 10 feet away. I want to just go get
it. I pulled it up online here.
Okay. Go to the last page. And
no,
they're standing in the rain.
They're laughing.
They're laughing. And then there's no more laughing. The laughter stops.
Right.
With the implication that Batman probably breaks his neck. Or again, it's not like, well, here's clearly what happens. But it's like, I see it this way. I just assume that he did this. And now that I've thought that, I'm like, that makes total sense. And why does it just cut off? Like, why does the laughter just cut off?
I think I just always assumed like it kind of, it drowns out in the rain. But maybe Joker's supposed to be dead. I don't know. Anyway, Watchmen. What's up with Watchmen?
Watchmen is all like, I was going somewhere with that. Now I can't remember what it was because we're talking about the Killing Joke.
Sorry.
Who brought up the Killing Joke?
I'm almost positive it was Adam Risky.
With it, and he had props of a Jewish
Alan Moore
singing ornament. Yeah,
yeah. Well, I was going to say that there are some dramatic moments in the film that don't work for me, and again, this is not necessarily Zack Snyder's strong suit. He is more of a visualist than a dramatist. And some of that stuff is just really on the nose. Some of it works on the page. You know, you can have Dan Dreiberg or whatever say, like, what happened to the American dream on the page? And I don't even remember if that's a literal quote from the book. But when he says it in the film and the comedian responds with, you know, we're living it or whatever, it is sort of ham-fisted and awkward. Some of the dialogue that works on the page doesn't work when humans have to speak it. And so sometimes I think there's a determination to be faithful to the words that is hard for actors to sort of wrap their mouths around, and does a little bit of a disservice. I would also argue, listen, I am what you would call a fan of Carla Gugino, okay?
Yeah.
You might say I am in love with her. I am a fan, and I think she's very talented. I've seen her be great in stuff. Anybody who used to watch Karen Sisko knows what I'm talking about.
That was me.
Having said that, the scene where Malin Ackerman goes to see her in the sort of retirement home, Carla Gugino's performance in that scene is not good. I think it's really not good. I think it's like a high schooler doing a Tennessee Williams play. Not good. Like, I don't understand why she modulated her performance that way.
Like Winona Ryder at the end of Edward Scissorhands wearing old age makeup. Not good.
It's not the old age makeup that bothers me. The makeup throughout the film is actually kind of bad. And part of me thinks that's on purpose. Like the Nixon,
I think it's
is
on purpose.
Yeah. I mean the comedian makeup, and they're supposed to be, you know, like in their 70s, and they basically look like attractive 40-year-old actors with a little bit of makeup on. The Nixon one is particularly egregious, but to me, that's very intentional that he just looks like a weird monster almost. they didn't really attempt to make him look like Nixon. They attempted like a weird, ugly drawing of Nixon. Yeah. Which to me seems intentional, but so some of that stuff doesn't work for me as well dramatically. Again, does it ruin the film? No, because I don't think that's where the film's strengths are. And its strengths are very much able to overcome those kinds of things, but I just felt like it was worth mentioning.
Anything else you don't like that you want to bring up while
I'm
we're talking
sure
about it?
Sure, there's some stuff. Listen, I don't like Patrick Wilson's response when Jackie Earle Haley gets vaporized. He goes full on Darth Vader. but, you know, I admire the fact that Zack Snyder kept that ending. Because you could see a version of the film where, you know, someone is like, I don't know, people seem to really like this Rorschach character. Let's let him live. And that flies in the face of what the film is about. So yeah.
This Rorschach character sells lunchboxes. Action figure. Well, he actually does sell action figures, but.
Sure.
Yeah. Point taken.
I saw somebody once at a Comic-Con with a Rorschach mask that moved. I didn't know how they did it. I wanted to ask how they were doing it. Yeah, it was really cool. I mean, you see a lot of Rorschachs at Comic-Con, but like,
yeah,
this was the best one I'd ever seen.
Speaking of Rorschach's mask, like that was a really cool choice, and I just want to give a shout out for that. Like in the book, it's the ink spots are constantly in different places, and I don't know how they would have done that in the movie, but they did it, and it works, and I love it. It's constantly in motion.
Yeah. Again, most of the stuff that translates, I think, translates really well. And there's so much that I like about the movie. You know, I think.
All right, so what else don't you like? Go ahead.
No. I'm not coming up with more stuff. I'm just saying, like, the reason that this is one of my favorite kind of superhero comic book movies, and I think was one of my favorite movies the year it came out, 2009. It was on my top 10 somewhere. Is because it is. It's so based on, you know, this other thing, but in the realm of superhero comic book movies, it feels so unique. It feels very daring. You know what I mean? Like, for as much as it relies on the source material, I really feel like Zack Snyder kind of laid it all on the line. He took a chance just by adapting it in the first place, because everybody said this is unfilmable. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a really audacious movie. Again, not everybody loves the use of the My Chemical Romance cover of Desolation Row in the end credits, right? I happen to love it. I think
I
it's
like
very
it.
Much in the spirit of the film that he made.
Do you note that it starts with a Bob Dylan song and it ends with a cover of a Bob Dylan song?
Yeah. I think it's a movie that takes a lot of big swings, and I don't know. I love that. You know, I love a movie that takes big swings. I love it even more when it takes big swings and happens to connect, which I think this one does. I'll give a movie a pass that takes big swings and misses every one of them. This one I don't think does. This one I think connects most of the time. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a really, I think it's a great piece of filmmaking. I think it's the best thing that Zack Snyder has done pretty handily. I mean, I like his Dawn of the Dead, but, I think it's a pretty great film.
Yeah. And this movie has so much to say to every character in this. I could follow in their own movie. There's just so much substance to it, and it feels, I don't even know how to say it, but it feels true to me. It feels like it understands people, and it understands the mistakes that we make, and it understands our hopes, and it understands what drives us. It understands humanity in a way that a lot of superhero movies don't. And I don't want that from all my superhero movies either. I mean, I think there's a beauty and a joy to just being able to say, okay, we need heroes because things are really gross and dark outside and everyone wants to kill us. We need to go somewhere where we can spend 2 hours watching people save us and us not having to worry about that. But Watchmen's not that movie, and it never wanted to be that movie. It's a deconstruction of what we can be and who we are. And I love it for that. And I think that it really succeeds almost all the way through. I love Jackie Earle Haley's performance. Love it. We didn't talk enough about him. Like, I think he's great.
He's great. No, he's great. He's great. And again, he was the one when they announced his casting, you were like, yeah. And then you see the movie and you're like, yeah, that's a tough performance to pull off based on what's on the page. And he really, really gets it and makes no attempt to make Rorschach likable or sane. Everything about it works.
And the scene right when he gets offed, right before the Darth Vader no, like the emotion on his face is incredible to me. Like he's shaking with fear and anger and whatever else. It's amazing to me.
And that works in part because of the shot that I was complaining about earlier where he sees his mom being a prostitute. I just wish that that had been placed somewhere else. I just feel like its placement feels off, but I think it's an important piece of information in terms of understanding his character, because when he's screaming "do it" at the end, I mean, it is informed by a lifetime of pain, you know.
You're talking about in the opening credits?
Yeah, opening montage.
Because they revisit it later in the movie, so why have it twice?
It doesn't need to be twice, yeah.
It is, yeah. So I don't know, but you're right. They could have put something else there, something iconic.
Right. I don't know what.
The Beatles on Ed Sullivan. But instead of the Beatles, it's like Dr. Manhattan and
it should have been the Beatles on Ed Sullivan and then just like the comedian standing just off stage tapping his foot.
I like it. He's like
just totally Forrest Gumping everything about Watchmen. Like, oh, and comedian. They were there for that too.
That's right. My name's the comedian. I'll play guitar. That's what they should have done.
Again, like "Mother, forgive me" is a great line on the page, but when he has to like stop the fight scene to say it's all a joke, "Mother, forgive me," it feels a little bit shoehorned in. These are minor complaints. I love the movie.
I don't even remember him saying that.
It's in the very first scene where he's getting his ass kicked. Oh, also, Zack Snyder, you don't need to make a dumb little cutesy 300 reference in your opening. Like, if you're going to do Watchmen,
the room number.
Do Watchmen. Like, if you're going to be slavishly faithful to it, be slavishly faithful to it. You don't have to reference your own filmography.
Yeah, I noticed that.
So dumb, right? I'm really not that upset about it.
It was distracting. You don't want to be reminded, like, while you're watching a movie, oh, yeah, 300.
To pull you out right away and be like, I also made this. All right, very
before
good.
Before we get started, this is Sparta.
Anything else to say about Watchmen?
No, it's really great. It's a fantastic movie. And I think, I do think time will be kind to it, and it will be, everything seems to get rediscovered. And I think this will get rediscovered, maybe just discovered for the first time. Probably within the next 5 or 10 years, and people will be like, hey, this movie's pretty good.
I hope so. I think it deserves to be, and I think if Zack Snyder is going to have an entire career of directing superhero movies, because if I'm not mistaken, after Batman v Superman Dawn of Justice, he is directing Justice League, yes?
I don't know. I'm on IMDb, though, and I can tell you. Let's see. Zack Snyder.
I thought he was, like, all in on the DC universe. And so this is going to be, you know, the next several years of his filmography is going to be populated by just big superhero movies. And I would hope that when that run is over, people kind of step back and say, yeah, but, you know, this all started with Watchmen, and that movie's fucking great.
Yeah, you're right. It is Justice League Part 1 in 2017 and then Part 2 in 2019.
Right. So
we've got four more years of this good stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, so nothing else to say about Watchmen?
No, I feel like we covered it.
Me too. I think it's good.
It's okay. It's pretty good. That's pretty good.
Thank you guys very much for listening. As always, you can find our website at fthismovie.net. Follow us on Twitter. We are at fthismovie. Like us on Facebook. Listen to us on Stitcher or in the iTunes store. If you're a fan and you want to leave us a review, we always appreciate that. You can email us show suggestions or notes at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com. If I don't get back to you all the time right away, I promise I will try, but I do read your suggestions, and I promise to do my best to incorporate them. So if you feel like you're just shouting into the void, I promise you are not. I think we have one more show before our Force Awakens spectacular. Depending on how that comes together, we will see. So I don't know what next week's show is going to be, but we're gearing up for Star Wars, and I'm hoping we are all excited. Thank you, Heath, for talking Watchmen with me.
Thank you for having me and talking about this with me.
And we will talk to you guys next week.
Heath Holland's Journal recorded a podcast with Patrick Bromley tonight.
And then you go out on Desolation Row.
Thanks for listening to FS Movie.